once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And in this exciting show, you will hear from Jeff and Jake, who are not coincidentally principals of something other than this radio presentation. In fact, they are both principal advisors, advising members of the Personal Wealth Coach, which is a investment advisory firm operating out of Salado that manages wealth for people that have wealth to manage. And what else do we need to say? Anything else? Nothing
nope.
said on this
nope,
show constitutes done. Investment advice. We don't give tax or legal advice. So if you're listening to this show, it's either for education or entertainment, and I think more towards the entertainment side.
Then we're not doing a very good job.
We're not?
No. How entertaining can we possibly be? We're two economist-minded folks that are talking on a Saturday morning about things that people probably don't even want to talk about on a Wednesday morning.
Hmm. Well, I guess that does make a certain degree of sense. So we could be really glum.
Well, it is the dreary science, so we'll be talking
dismal,
about it.
Dismal.
Dismal, and yeah, I guess dismal,
it's the dismal science
as well.
Yes, okay. So, what happened this week?
Well, depending on who you believe, we began the work week on Monday, but the week itself on Sunday. So, the beginning of the week is already confused because we don't know which day it started on.
And we don't know when it started. As I've told a lot of people, you can actually see into the future under some circumstances, and this weekend there were several times you could see into the future this last weekend and over during the week, because if you look at the moon, if you can see the moon runs on what we used to call Greenwich Mean Time, now it's called Universal Coordinated Time. I guess it was uncoordinated before.
It was just Greenwich.
Right, but it's actually 6 hours ahead of Central Time in the United States, therefore
looking at the moon.
Right. If you look at the moon any time after 6 p.m. and you can see the moon, you are seeing tomorrow before it arrives.
And if you're in Central Time Zone. Now, if
right.
you're in the Eastern Time Zone.
It's only 5 hours.
It's only 5 hours ahead. So you have to wait till
right.
7 o'clock
so we'll get
you're
a,
seeing the future.
Yeah, we'll get a six-hour warning if the world ends.
Yeah. Or, no, we won't. We'll get a six-hour warning if the moon ends.
Well, if the world ended and there wasn't a world here anymore, the moon's trajectory would change rather dramatically.
That's true. So looking into the future based on the time zone of the moon, we should be able to predict our own destruction. Unfortunately, if you live in the United Kingdom, you can't see the future by looking at the moon because it is the present. There are places on the planet by looking at the moon you see the past.
Yes. Well, no, I don't know if you do or not. I mean,
you just start going east of UK.
Well, if you go east of UK, yeah, I guess. I don't know. It's very confusing. East of the United Kingdom, I guess you're looking
some places,
at the past. You're
if you get
at,
out to Siberia, you're maybe even looking into the distant past.
That's right. Well, there's a lot of rationale behind the idea that if you're in Siberia, you're in the
past. Yeah, it's very true. So anyway, that's one of those fun things, if you've got kids, to tell your kids. If you don't have kids, to tell your rather odd friends, because they're the only people that would think it was interesting.
And if you don't have any odd friends, just tell yourself, because you will be your odd
you
friend.
You can be your odd friend. Yes.
So let's see. We'd like to talk about the stock market, and today is Saturday, February 11th. And we would also like to say that we have a telephone number that you can call in here, and you can ask questions, you can make comments. You can make animal noises. We're not too particular, as long as you don't talk about team sports. So,
or even solo sports, for that matter.
Some solo sports we know a little bit about, but not much. But anyway, so the telephone number is, of course, the local area code is 254, and it's 773-1400. We also, by the way, monitor our email, and that's either Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. So if you would send something in by email, we probably will catch it as it goes by. And unless the email system determines that you're J-U-N-Q-U-E, in which case it'll just dump it.
It's a unique spelling of the word junk.
Yeah, which is the equivalent of high yield. Anyway, the stock market this week stayed, the New York Stock Exchange at least, stayed at 44 West Wall Street. And
so when people say that, boy, the stock market was moving today,
well, it is. I mean,
I think it's moving with the planet.
Yeah, but
still sitting in the same place in the same road. And,
yeah, but we're roughly. I just read a very, very good treatise on how fast we're really moving. We're moving relative to the microwave background radiation, which is the only fixed reference we have, about 1,000,000 miles an hour towards Sagittarius.
I just got a real quick update, relatively speaking, from my daughter, which is to say that we're not moving at all.
Mm. You're not?
No, and the moon follows us.
There's probably some degree of truth in both of those. Anyway, the stock market, at least is represented by the Dow Jones Industrial Average, was up 0.99% this week. The S&P 500 was up 0.81%. Woohoo! You know, but you can look at it a little differently, and you can say that here we are about a month and a half into the year, and the Dow's up 2.56%, and the S&P 500 is up 3.45%. That sounds a lot more interesting. What's even more interesting is the fact that the S&P 500, compared with where it was 1 year ago, is up 24.2%. I haven't seen any big headlines on that. I don't know why the news, I guess they're so busy following President Trump that they don't notice that this would be a sensational headline.
Right.
And everybody would then thunder out and say, 24% a year I should invest in the stock market. Well, that's not probably what it will do over the next year, though.
What we're seeing in politics and in the media right now is that the majority of Americans are being left behind.
They are?
Yes. The president says something sensational. The media cannot help themselves. They must go rabidly forth to say how wrong he is about whatever it is. And while they have their discourse about Madonna or Lady Gaga or whatever it is that they're having their discourse rabidly at each other, the rest of us are trying to figure out what's really important in our lives. So one piece of the stock market, you were talking about that. Last week we talked about Snapchat. Mm-hmm. You remember this conversation. We were warning folks that there's an IPO coming out from Snapchat. It's Snap Inc. That is solely comprised of non-voting shares. So we were giving warning last week that this seems a little bit strange and not something we want to be involved in. And Snap has not been profitable ever. It's losing money at large rates. And so this week, I want to give you some news. Snap Interactive dropped 10% to just over $8 midday. Okay.
Why? Because somebody listened to our radio
program? It could be. Reversing a huge run-up in the stock price, which got as high as $9.98 at one point. That's 122% jump from $4.50 just about a week ago.
Which means it is a speculative penny stock that probably should be stayed away from.
Well, let me come at this. Did you hear the name of the company I said?
Snap.
Yeah. So Snap Inc. has an IPO still coming up. But news media started reporting the movement of Snap Interactive. So people got confused and thought maybe the IPO had already happened. And so they started buying a company that had nothing to do with the IPO.
Well, that's what highly educated investors do.
Right. Extremely highly educated people that do a lot of research.
Sophisticated stock purchasers.
What that says is that this IPO is going to be volatile and it's probably going to have a run up and then a really rapid run down. And that's not by any stretch guaranteed. But when you have that kind of reaction to a company that isn't even the correct company, the people involved in this company, by the way, Snap Interactive was founded in 2005. It's been traded publicly since 2006. It is not Snapchat. It provides dating applications.
Oh, cool.
But because it's in social media and people can look it up, they just do the Snap look and they see Snap Eye, and Snap Interactive pops up when you're doing a search on Google for finance. Instead of Snap Inc., they got Snap Interactive. Now, Snap Tools hasn't had any moves that are major up or down. Snap tools isn't interactive. It doesn't look like the right thing. So
snap, they're very interactive tools because they snap together.
Right. The CEO of Snap Interactive said that they intend to release no press releases, clarifying the difference in the companies. But when people call to ask them questions about Snapchat, they inform them that they've reached the wrong company. As far as he's concerned, he's quite happy with the people investing in his company because his stock price is going up.
Well,
just thought that was an interesting piece of news to throw into the mix.
Right there in the midst of that, in that same issue of crazy speculators in the market, which I don't know who does this, this type of thing, like buy the wrong snap.
Can you imagine clicking that button? Going, yeah, I got in ahead of the IPO. I'm so great. And then 5 days later going, there's something, wait, what company is this again?
There's something far more mundane going on. There's an article in Barron's, which is where I get all these numbers. But apparently, last year, there were 128 ETFs that disappeared.
ETFs are exchange-traded funds.
Yes, which are a very popular way of, quote, low-cost investing in an index or in a narrow piece of the market or something.
It's also an acronym for electronically transferred funds, which is not the same thing at all.
Right.
But when we talk about ETFs here, we're talking about these strange things that sort of act like mutual funds.
And there's about 500 that probably will disappear this year.
Is there a magician involved?
Well, no, they just cease to exist. And this is the funny thing, and if you're doing any investing, you may be hearing that you should buy this ETF or that ETF and this one. This is unlike mutual funds, although some ETFs are mutual funds technically.
Yeah, unlike, let's just make it even more confusing.
Unlike regular mutual funds, ETFs, when they disappear, don't merge into someplace else. They just go away. In some cases, and this is really weird, they give the investors an opportunity to sell the fund that's about to cease to exist, which means that they have a really hard time finding anybody who will buy it from them. In other cases, the fund simply ceases to exist, in which case you now hold shares of something that doesn't exist, which is a little hard to deal with sometimes.
Let's explain how these work a little bit, because and I know some people get upset with us because we get into too much detail, but I believe that if you understand how things work, it gives you a better rationale for dealing with the things. The concept behind an ETF is not that different from the concept behind a mutual fund. It just doesn't have the regulatory protections in many cases that a mutual fund does. So basically, it's a pool where you throw money in, and so do a lot of other people. And then that fund, there's a manager in it at some point, not for forever in many cases. Sometimes the manager's there the whole time, and sometimes the manager leaves right after the fund opens. They take that pool of money, and they buy a bunch of investments. Stocks, bonds, whatever it is that they're trying to do. In some cases, that's it. It's done. The manager leaves. Those stocks are what's held by the ETF, and it goes for a certain period of time, and then sometimes it has a set date where it liquidates. Other times it has a set no date, it just goes on forever with those stocks in it, not actively managed. There are other times when the manager stays in there. And all of this stuff gets obfuscated when you're getting in unless you know what to look for.
It's an interesting thing when they fold up and when you get the fact that there's about 2,000 exchange-traded funds out there and just under 2,000, and about 500 of them look like they're going to fold this year. That means that 25% of the ETFs currently on the market are probably going to cease to exist. Now, when they cease to exist, it's kind of funny. Sometimes they return your money. Sometimes they say, okay, it's worth this much, we're going to return your money. But here's the kicker. They charge typically, well, recently at least, macro shares, for example, charge 3% of assets when it closed four funds. So they're going to charge you a percentage, and ETFs are famous because they're no load, they're inexpensive, but when they charge, inevitably there is a fee levied to you. In other words, they take the money, they take a certain amount of the money, and they keep it, and the rest of it they send back to you. It gets more interesting if they don't do it that way. And by the way, ETFs are also famous because they have very little taxable income associated with them. In this particular case, and so, what happens if they liquidate?
Taxable right then.
Instant taxable event, and then you get to argue with the IRS over what kind of tax it is. But it gets better if they delist it. Because if they delist it, you're just left with a share. And trying to find somebody who will buy it from you on an unlisted share. Anyway, so we have a caller.
Yeah, we've got some more information on how they could close up, what would cause it, what your recourse is, if any. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, gents, enjoyed the show. Last week, you guys were talking about the Labor Department's fiduciary rule.
Mm-hmm.
I saw something in the Wall Street about the SEC, I guess, is trying to float one. What's the difference in the two, and which one do you think will win? I'll hang up on this and take it.
All right.
SEC's trying to float one.
Yeah, well, let's get this right out in the open first off. The SEC already has a definition for fiduciary.
Mm-hmm.
It's been out for a long time. What they have been trying to do in this float is make it match the Labor Department's definition. Whether or not that actually happens is, you know, when you're talking about regulatory anything, whether or not anything ever happens is kind of up in the air. The Labor Department's been working on the fiduciary definition and guidelines since the Pension Protection Act of 2006, so 11 years now. It's gone through a huge process, even with a law saying it must happen. The president is now up reviewing it again. The new people being appointed to the Labor Department are now questioning whether or not they are going to be even enforcing it. So let's take two steps back, shall we? The term fiduciary is not as commonly used as we wish it were. Fiduciary, in its most basic sense, means that if someone is acting as a fiduciary for you, they must be acting in your best interest. Now, they're allowed to be compensated. Please understand that. Compensation is needed. If you're dealing with somebody that's giving you advice and it's good advice, you should be paying for it. If they're helping you do things that you find are beneficial to yourself, you should be paying for it. The thing with the fiduciary is they're supposed to tell you how much they're getting paid and how. So full disclosure of fees and full disclosure of all conflicts of interest while working in your best interest. Now, the Labor Department says working in your sole interest. The SEC says working in your best interest. They're slightly different standards, not hugely different. They are both head and shoulders, torso, and most of the legs ahead of the suitability standard, which just says we're working for a company and you're going to get what you get.
And that's the financial advisor standard. The investment advisors are required by the SEC to hold to a fiduciary standard that's already there. Now, let me
– and by the way, just as a side note, this is not a this is more of a main note. That disclosure we give at the beginning of the radio program, our firm is registered as a fiduciary already with the SEC as an investment advisory registered with the SEC. That's not them saying, yes, you guys are great. It just means that we have now signed up for all of the punishment that can come due if we don't hold to that standard well, which is why we say we're not offering investment advice on the air because we don't know you all. It'd be nice if we did.
I don't know.
Getting to know you all would take up more than the 2 hours that we have.
Right. The SEC floating something, Mary Jo White said something last year about
– that's the former head of the SEC.
Right. About doing a uniform fiduciary standard by April. But here's the problem. The SEC, which normally has, let's see, five members on
it. Yeah, five commissioners.
Only has two right now.
A Republican and a Democrat.
And they're not going to do anything for a long time because they only have two members.
And if they tie – they die.
Yeah. And
it's done.
And whatever she said is out the window anyway, because we're going to have a new commission.
New president, new commission.
And but the point is that there is a standard, but only investment advisors have to follow it. And the SEC has been very clear about what that standard is for a long time. Financial advisors are not required to be fiduciaries. They're not required to act in your best interest. And the problem with the DOL rule, which, by the way, has some interesting...
Wait, let me just clarify one thing, because you just said investment advisor and financial advisor, and people go, what's the difference? There's a legal difference. Legal. Investment advisor has a law around it, meaning fiduciary. Financial advisor, you can be a financial advisor with zero training by giving your grandmother advice on how to balance her checkbook.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And then advising financially.
And the only education required... is that you pass a test saying you know what the rules are that FINRA puts out
you
there.
You don't even need that to be a financial advisor. That term has no legal protection. So you can say I'm a financial advisor if you're helping the checkout person at HEB.
You're
by
correct.
Saying
anybody
the $20, $20 bills go in that slot.
Right.
That's financial advice.
So with regard to the Department of Labor rules, a couple of interesting, which is the controversial one that was going to say, at least with regard to with IRAs, no matter whether you were a financial advisor or an investment advisor or whatever you called yourself or an insurance agent, if you're going to give advice or you're going to put people into IRAs, you're going to roll over 401ks, you're going to go from one IRA to another IRA, you had to follow, you had to become a fiduciary.
Or you had to write a contract with the client saying that you were not going to be operating in their best interest, and they needed to understand that.
And there's been, within the industry, the financial product industry, that's called the financial services industry, but it's really financial product industry, there's been a great deal of upset and yelling and screaming about that. And President Trump issued an executive order asking the Department of Labor to kill this thing somehow, some way. The Department of Labor this week filed to delay. They filed with the Office of Management and Budget. We don't know exactly what the filing is because the OMB hasn't turned it back out again to delay it. And then they're going to post it in the Federal Register. And it very well could be that the people who are dealing with your IRAs and your retirement accounts will not have to act in your best interest as a result.
A lot of confusion. We don't know what's going on there yet.
But at the same time, late this week, a judge in Dallas, who was expected to rule against the DOL's Department of Labor's fiduciary rule on IRAs, said, nope, there's nothing violating the law or the Constitution about the Department of Labor making a rule saying that the financial advisors and everybody else have to act in the best interest of the people who are doing IRAs. And that was a very disappointing to the financial industry. And but then we turn around and get an executive order and we get the Department of Labor saying we're going to delay it and possibly indefinitely.
Now, the large investment banks and broker dealers, the biggest ones, have all come out and said what they intend to do anyway. So, for instance, Bank of America, they intend to stop doing business in IRAs, period. And they still intend to do that. They've come out with their announcement and said that they are no longer going to deal with IRAs starting sometime between April and the end of the year.
But that's subject to change.
That's subject to change. Raymond James says, hey, you guys, we need to keep with the fiduciary standard. If the fiduciary standard's out there, we're going to go ahead and do it. As far as we're concerned, we're already fiduciaries, so that makes it easy for us. We've taken the Labor Department standard since it was made public, and we've been using that as our definition for fiduciary across the board, even in non-IRA positions. So there are a lot of people that still understand that being a fiduciary and understanding what that means and letting the client know what that means is good for everybody. But there are still a lot of people out there that would rather not have it come up. They would rather continue business as usual to get paid what they get paid, and you know what it is by looking it up in the prospectus rather than them having to tell you how they get paid, which for many people is a very uncomfortable conversation. I think it's something, if you're the employer, you should know what you're paying your employees. I think that's kind of a standard business management tool. If you don't know what you're paying your employees, you may not be as profitable as you think you are.
There is a misconception regarding what an investment advisor does and a financial advisor does. A financial advisor generally will charge commissions. The commissions don't show up on your statement. You look like you buy a share at a certain value, and then it goes up and down, and you don't worry about it anymore. But you don't see any big fees subtracted normally from your statements. You don't see, okay, we're charging you this many dollars this month. In fact, it's going on. You just don't see it. And I won't say this is going to happen in every case, but in most cases, when you're dealing with an investment advisor, they're going to find, they are actually required to find, the least expensive version of, for example, a mutual fund or whatever you're purchasing. And if they find the least expensive, at least this is just our experience, that the internal fees that you're not paying may exceed the fees that the investment advisor is charging you. Now, let me put a little caveat in there. If you're dealing with an investment advisor who's also a broker, for instance, Edward Jones has got an office near ours where they're both financial, they both offer brokerage services where they charge commissions, and they offer investment advisory services from the same guy to the same clients in many cases. You need to look at the fees they're charging. They may be charging you, let's say, 1.5%. If they're charging 1.5%, I can assure you that you're paying more than you would if you just went and bought a regular mutual fund from them over the long term. So the in some cases, when a person is wearing both hats, they're both an investment advisor representative and a financial advisor, the fees do go up. But generally speaking, and this isn't universal, but generally speaking, if you discuss this with somebody who is an investment advisor or an investment advisory firm, you'll find out that the fees you're paying them plus the underlying fees of, let's say, the mutual funds or something are lower than if you just went out and bought the mutual fund. So it is a little complicated, and it's one of those things we're not used to doing. We're not used to talking to our financial person, whoever it is, about what they're charging us.
I think it's an important conversation to have.
It's kind of like, right now, I'm, and some of you are in the same position, I'm sure you're in a position where we haven't met our deductibles on our insurance, on our health insurance. And so we're getting to see exactly what gets charged when I go to a doctor's office. And by the way, this is changing my attitude about a doctor's visit, because I realize I am now, right now, paying out of pocket a pretty substantial chunk of change every time I go see a doctor.
So you're not just the patient, you're also the customer.
Right.
Which means that you have some say in what you're being charged.
And I, you know, at the very least, I look at him and say, look, I'm paying you a couple of $100 for 15 minutes. I expect a little more quality out of this visit than I just got. And I'm not going to say that I would, that in my particular case that's true, but this is one of the things that the fact that if you have a relatively high deductible health insurance program and you see what you're actually paying when you go see a doctor and what your insurance premiums are paying for when the insurance is paying, it's already starting to change the attitude people have towards health care. They're beginning to demand a little more quality out of their health care. There's some indication. Because we now know this is what I'm being charged. Whereas before, in many cases, and if you're one of those people who don't have high deductible health insurance, you probably still are unaware how much that system that you go to is charging you or somebody every time you see a physician. But and I recommend you do this. You have a discussion. Say, how much a year, how much a month is the combination of your fees and the mutual funds and everybody else's? And if the guy says, well, I really don't know, read the prospectus carefully prior to investing or something like that, or if they say, well, you know, you don't really pay me, the company does. Come on. Company subtracts money from what you invest, and they then keep some of it and send some of it on to the financial advisor you're working with. And there's nothing wrong with that system. It's just you need to know. And by the way, the objection from many people who don't like the Department of Labor's fiduciary rule is they, particularly the insurance agents who sell annuities, have objected very, very strongly to disclosing the amount of money the insurance company and the agent makes when you buy a fixed or indexed annuity. Those things, you will be amazed to find that in many cases they're paying the agent 7 or 8%.
On a fixed annuity, sometimes, you know, equity index fixed annuity, sometimes mm-hmm. it's 11% commission.
Right.
There are cases where it's higher than that.
And so if you realize how much you're paying, you might be a little more reluctant to pay that much. And that's what they're a little concerned about right now. Well, they're more than a little concerned. They're very concerned. and they have lobbied really, really hard to get any required any disclosure
possible.
Killed.
Okay. Now, let's leave that subject for a minute and talk about another subject that we've talked about in the past, but there's some new information. The Export-Import Bank. All right, have you seen anything come up this week about that?
No, I didn't. But
Donald Trump has come out in support of the Export-Import Bank.
Good guy.
Yeah, this is one of those things where we were quite worried because during the campaign, he said some really bad things about the Export-Import Bank. Well, now either he's done the research and recognizes that it's a pretty good thing. It puts us on a level playing field with the rest of the world when we're doing trade. Or he listened to somebody who did the research for him. Whatever, he's come out in support of the Export-Import Bank. What does that do? The Export-Import Bank makes loans to American companies that are either exporting or importing large amounts of goods overseas. So if you're going into, let's see, Germany, and you're wanting to sell new flying cars, there we go. How's that for a good? It's better than just saying widgets. You've got a company that's developed flying cars, and you want to sell them in Germany. Well, the German flying car manufacturers have just gotten a big loan from the government of Germany saying that they will be able to compete with you in Italy. If you don't get a low interest loan, you can't compete with the Germans in Italy. The Export-Import Bank has money specifically for that, to say, here's a low interest loan so that you can compete on a level playing field. Other people are getting loans in this on this industry in other countries, and we need to provide the same. There was a period of about 5 months last year where the Export-Import Bank had to be shut down, and that had a large impact on not the major companies out there, because they really rarely use the Export-Import Bank. Some of them use them majorly, but the most of those loans go to smaller companies that are just getting into this area. And you have something to add?
Well, on the Export-Import Bank, just update on what that really is, what's going on with it right now, is there's a representative who had lunch with a Democratic representative,
right.
Who had lunch with the president, and he told her that he would be nominating a board member to the Export-Import Bank in the near future. Now, why is that important? The Export-Import Bank for the last roughly year has not had a quorum, which means they can't loan more than $10 million to any company, which means that the biggest portion of their activities for huge companies like Caterpillar and so on was basically shut down. And
General Electric, Boeing, these are big companies that do business with the help of the Export-Import Bank, because when they go up against their competitors in the rest of the world and their competitors are getting low-interest loans from governmental positions, they can't compete if they're having to go somewhere else for the money.
And the Export-Import Bank, in most cases, by the way, does not actually make the loan. They simply
guarantee it.
Guarantee the loan so that and here's why they need to guarantee a loan. For example, there was a big brouhaha a while back about the fact that the Export-Import Bank loaned some companies in the United States money to provide equipment to Petrobras in Brazil to drill offshore oil wells. And the discussion among in Congress, at least, was that, oh, we're loaning money to help the Brazilians.
No, we're loaning
money to help the companies in the United States, because when they said, okay, we want to loan money to the Brazilian-owned, the nationally-owned oil company of Brazil to drill some oil wells, we'd want to loan some money. We want to provide them with equipment. They want to buy it. The big banks, particularly after the crisis, looked at that and said, well, what if Brazil just defaults on the loan? Well, so we're not going to make you the loan. And so they turned to the Export-Import Bank and said, would you guarantee the loan? And they said, sure, no problem. Because why? Why? Because if the United States government has some skin in the game, Brazil is probably not going to default on the loan, because the U.S. provides aid and other things to Brazil so they would realize that it would just get sucked out of the aid that we would otherwise be sending to Brazil for something else, or we'd stop buying oil from them or something.
Right.
So the fact that the Export-Import Bank guarantees an international loan means that loan is almost certainly going to get paid, because the United States government is not going to stand by idly and let it not get paid.
Right.
And so a bank in the United States then can loan the money to the big company that's making the equipment so that we can have jobs in the United States and we can do exports. And these are all things that President Trump wants. Yep. Jobs, exports, and healthy manufacturing in
right.
the United States.
This is the key here. This is a tool that has been neglected and beaten up while the rest of the world keeps their nice and shiny version of the tool. Our version of the tool has been neglected under the Obama administration. The Republicans in Congress aren't big fans of it either. So Obama didn't appoint the right number of board members. Even if he had, the Republicans may not have approved them. If Trump looks at his policies and says, this is a way for American companies to compete overseas without starting a trade war, there's a tool that already exists that is already acceptable to the rest of the world as a method of letting business flow. We were at a record low in loans guaranteed by the Export-Import Bank last year. It provided for 52,000 jobs. That's the lowest amount that the Export-Import Bank has provided through guaranteed loans since 1971. And in the process, those loans, when they're guaranteed, the U.S. government gets paid when those get paid back, because they're guaranteeing it. They get part of the interest. And last year, they put the Export-Import Bank contributed $284 million back into the coffers of the U.S. Treasury. What that says is that the more that the Export-Import Bank functions, the more revenue that we get as a government from trade overseas, period. This is exactly what the president is looking for. And there's another subject that kind of to be broached right here.
But the subject that we really need to broach right now is commercials.
Yes, we do need to play some commercials. I want to talk about Mexico after the break and talk about how that fits in with the Export-Import. So if you'd like to join us after the break, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and we will...
And this is the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yes, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
And we were talking about the fiduciary area before. I said Jeff had just been talking about commissions and how they were different on the fiduciary world. And I said that Bank of America would no longer be doing IRAs. And I needed to throw in there, they're not doing commissionable IRAs. They're still, if you have IRAs at Bank of America or Merrill Lynch, they're not going to dump you. And they are actually still taking IRAs, but they will be doing it on a fiduciary side. So even if the rule doesn't go into effect, it is having a massive impact on the whole industry. And I think it's going to be a positive impact in that you will be able to look at what you're paying and know what you're paying and know that the advice, at least on the IRAs, it may not be on the rest of your investments, but at least on the IRAs, you'll know you're working with a fiduciary. We were in the middle of talking about trade right before the break-end, and the trade issue was talking about the Export-Import Bank, and one of the articles that I read, and you may have seen something about it, was the Mexico response, the Mexican response to a lot of what the president has said has not been that positive. And it's not that long ago, pre-NAFTA and even the beginning of NAFTA, that trade in Mexico was really, really backwards. they had massive barriers to trade, tariffs, and so on. They were very proud of everything being made in Mexico, but the prices were high and the quality was low. They have a tendency to respond to tariffs with tariffs of their own, enough so that they can close their borders completely to new trade, and that would hurt us more than it would hurt them at this point. Maybe not as a whole, but as far as overall dollars, we would hurt more. As a percentage of their economy, it would affect them more. Did you see that article as well?
Right, I've seen several articles on the subject. There's a couple of things that are – one of the things that is just a reality out there is no matter how we throw a trade tariff on, even if it's a BAT, border adjustment tax, a lot of uncertainty pops up immediately. For example, if you buy an automobile made in the United States, assembled in Detroit with real live people, American workers assembling it, the parts in that automobile and the raw material in that automobile may have been back and forth across the border to Mexico 3 or 4 times. And if every time it comes back in the United States, we effectively put a 20% increase on the price of that part coming back in the United States, it will add, in all likelihood, several thousand dollars to the cost of an automobile in the United States. If we, for instance, in the wintertime, if you'll notice where your vegetables come from, we don't grow very many vegetables in the United States. We used to
in
grow
in the wintertime.
And right. We used to grow a lot in California. And the reason we stopped growing a lot in California, I was just reading an article on that, is we used to have a guest worker program.
No, there's another piece of that too. We used to have a lot of extra water there too.
Right. We used to have a guest worker program where people would come in to the places that are warm and they would harvest the vegetables and so on. That was cut off. And when it was cut off, it was amazing. They didn't hire American workers to go into the fields to harvest the vegetables.
Nope.
What they did is they stopped producing vegetables in the United States and started producing them in South America, which makes sense because it's summer down there when it's winter up here. And so a lot of our winter vegetables, even a lot, some of our summer vegetables are imported. And if you throw a 20% effective tax on stuff that's imported in the United States by a corporation, expect to see your vegetables go up maybe 20%, maybe more. It's just a reality.
It's likely to be more because the impact on the people doing the growing, it's going to cut the pay to the people doing the growing because you're less likely to want to pay 20% more. So you may just buy less tomatoes. You may buy less avocados. It's just, you know, it's cutting into the budget a little bit. So you buy a little bit less of it. Well, that's less money that goes back to the workers there. And we may wind up doing robotic growth of avocados and tomatoes in greenhouses, which is much more expensive than doing it in South America.
There was a study that came out last week, because there's been a lot of studies on this recently, that indicated that only about 2.5% of the job losses over the last 20 years have been in manufacturing, have been to jobs being exported overseas. But manufacturing has grown to record levels in the United States while the job decline continues. So where are the jobs going? And the answer is they're going to robots. And if we make it more expensive to make something in Mexico than a robot can make it in the United States, matter of fact, in our newsletter this week, we detail out some of the specific the cost of per year of employing a worker on an assembly line in Mexico versus the cost per year in the United States, about $75,000 a year to employ the average assembly line worker in the United States. Now, they don't make that much, but by the time they pay the benefits and the health insurance and everything else, it costs about $75,000 a year. And for about $1,000 a year, you can hire one in Mexico. So obviously, we would want to hire one in Mexico. And here's the kicker. It was hard to find detailed information on this, and it's going to vary from industry to industry, but General Motors seems to indicate that it costs about $5,000 a year, including depreciation. In other words, based on the initial price of a robot on an assembly line, and you spread it out over the years, and the robot's going to be there. It costs about $5,000 a year to put a robot on an assembly line. But the robot works 24 hours a day, works 3 shifts, so it just replaced 3 workers, except one of those workers at any given moment is on vacation or out sick. So it replaced 4 workers, And then if you actually throw in the fact that it is doing more than a worker was doing before, it actually is replacing five workers. So at that, what that means is the cost of a robot on an assembly line is about the same as an American worker. So why don't we do nothing but robots? Well, the answer is very simple. You have to throw a lot of money in up front to buy the robot, and it's cheaper to rent the wage earner in Mexico. But if we make it more expensive to rent the wage earner in Mexico, believe me, United States automobile makers will not bring back people at $75,000 a year.
No.
Because they can't afford to do that.
And the machine that they will buy is going to cost less than $75,000 a year. And you said something there. The initial cost has been getting lower and lower to start with a computerized or robotic system. So what has taken a change in hourly wages, for instance, an example of that is McDonald's, when the hourly wages went up on the West Coast in the different strange states over on the left coast, raising the minimum wage tremendously just meant that we needed to go to kiosks. So there's
right.
computerized kiosks coming out in
to a McDonald's near you.
To a McDonald's near you, because and jobs will be lost in the McDonald's near you. Because hourly wages changed in California and in Washington State, and that makes a big difference because the initial purchase, once it gets in and they realize, hey, this kiosk costs less than two employees, let's replace two employees with this kiosk, they're going to do it all across the country.
And we're getting close to the end of the hour, and by the way, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. I want to talk about some other things to do with what changes are going on in our economy as we go into the future. There's two big subjects we want to talk about next hour. One is the coming tax law.
Or maybe not coming tax law.
Well, there's going to be some change someplace, I think.
Somewhere there's going to be a change.
But we don't know what it's going to be. And every way that we come at it, it has negative and positive impacts. And there's some things you need to be aware of as an investor. The other thing is how manufacturing is changing. And Jake has got personal experience with it, and I've got personal experience with it. But you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail on the weekends and real live people during the week at local area codes 254, and then it's 947-1111.
If you want to reach that number toll free, it's 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Or go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Read our newsletters, philosophy, listen to our podcasts.
Please. And generally lower your IQ substantially.
Yes, and stay medicated, please, while listening. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
True. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.